My name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 27, 1975, and I'm very grateful. Woo-hoo! I grew up in Southern California, and, I've come face-to-face with every defect of character. Truly, they're all my good friends. But the one that is often not spoke about, but has been my biggest problem, has been my negative self-obsession. And, you know, by that I mean I've never been good enough, pretty enough, smart enough, funny enough, nothing. I've never been enough, you know. And so it's plagued me since, I was a little girl. I remember in kindergarten, I used to put my hair in front of my head, my face, because I didn't want anybody to see me. I just felt there was something wrong with me, and I didn't know what it was. And I don't know where that came from. I've tried to think back. I don't remember my parents ever saying mean things to me or, you know, anything like that. But for some reason, I felt just awkward. And so, like I said, I grew up in, after I got out of the hospital, when I was born, they took me to Hermosa Beach. And, and since I've been sober, I tell you, all the things that I felt self-pity for, I'm just so grateful. You know, I had no idea how lucky I was. Anyway, so I was, a little girl in Hermosa Beach. My mom was 19 when she had me. My dad was like 25, an older man. Anyway, and my dad was real not self-obsessed. He was obsessed. He had, both my mother and my father had lived through the Depression, and they both had kind of hard lives, my mom not so bad, but my father, his father had abandoned him when he was I'm not sure how old my brother was, but his brother, my father's brother, was dropped on his head when he was a baby by my grandfather. His name was Henry. Anyway, I never met him because Henry abandoned the family right after that happened. He felt such guilt, and I always thought he was drunk when it happened. I'm not sure if he was, but so my Uncle George became disabled after that for the rest of his life. And my father had promised my grandmother when she died, and she died when she was like 18, she died in childbirth, my father had promised her when she was in her deathbed that he would take care of Uncle George, for the rest of his life. And so I had this uncle who was kind of, let's say, interesting. He was kind of grumpy, and, he cursed all the time. Anyway, back then, Redondo Pier was kind of a seedy place, where the bad people hung out. And Uncle George was down there a lot. And but my father, he was pretty handy, and he built him a little bicycle where he could deliver newspapers and stuff like that. And my father really, because he had had such a hard childhood, with his mother and father passed away when he was very young. He lived with some relatives, and I don't think they were that thrilled he was there. And so anyway, when I came along, he really wanted to make a success. So he started this little business called Do It Yourself Builder Supply. And it was like a little baby Home Depot. And if it had been successful, my life would be fabulous. But unfortunately, he loaned some building products to somebody that couldn't pay him back. And so we went bankrupt when I was like 10 years old. And we escaped from Hermosa in the middle of the night. That's the way we did it back then. In the middle of the night, you ran off to Las Vegas. That's the way I thought it happened. Anyway, that's what happened to us. So we moved to Las Vegas, and my mom, who had been a housewife her whole life, became a cocktail waitress at the Silver Slipper. My father became an ornamental iron worker, and the thing was... Neither of my parents that I felt this. Other people don't believe it, but I didn't think my parents liked me very well. I mean, they just weren't, they didn't, they were very stoic, and they didn't sort of, they weren't real gushy, you know. And so I just didn't feel really that connected to them. And my grandmother that everybody loves, I didn't feel she liked me either. And I have a sister, she's 2 years older, and she's in really bad shape from alcoholism right now. She's never quit drinking, and she's 2 years older than me. And you know, she was a monster. She was a brat. And so I didn't like her either. So I didn't like any of my family. Anyway, and they didn't like me either. So so we were living in Las Vegas, and that, you know, a lot of people that in Las Vegas, you know, the kids I went to school with, they all wore cashmere sweaters and stuff, and, you know, my family didn't have any money because we had just gone bankrupt, and we lived in one of those cinder block house tracks, and, you know, we just didn't have any money, and I started feeling that low self-esteem, you know, like there was, you know, we didn't have any money, all these people had all these cashmere sweaters, and they didn't like me either. Nobody liked me. That was my negative self-obsession. Nobody liked me. And so I kind of moped around school. And anyway, one day my mother fell madly in love with the security guard at the Silver Slipper. She got rid of my father. She didn't kill him, though. They got divorced. Anyway. And my sister stayed with my father, and I came with my mother back to Los Angeles. And first, we stopped in North Hollywood. That was horrible. And then we went back. Somehow, magically, we ended up at the beach again. And but we were poor, you know. We hadn't any money, and I started going to this junior high in Redondo. And by magically, somehow or other. See, in my life, there's been a lot of magic. I don't know, you know. Anyway, I was put on this little, you know, junior high annual or something. And somehow I did this, like, centerfold thing that had, I drew cartoons and put in pictures of some of the popular kids. And it was, so people, you know how they sign your annual? And that was what that page was for. It was a double page. Anyway, people thought it was funny, and all of a sudden people started thinking I was funny. And I kind of liked that, you know. I started feeling not so horrible, you know. I never felt quite right, but still, that was the beginning of me feeling like things weren't so horrible. And so then I got out of that school, and I was living in North Redondo, which at the time was an undesirable city. And across the street, though, was Manhattan Beach, which is a very desirable city. And so I started going to high school in Manhattan Beach, and everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people had a lot of money. And they still do. I mean, there's family money down there. There's houses on the strand in Manhattan Beach that are beautiful, and they've been there forever. And now it's a big place where, like, people with lots of money from all over the world moved there. Anyway, when I was in high school, there was a lot of people with a lot of money and a lot of attitude, you know? And so somehow, though, well, I'll tell you what happened. I went through puberty, and suddenly I fit into a bikini. So I started hanging around. I had a boyfriend on the swim team, you know, Mark Spitz, those cute guys. And I started hanging around at the beach with the surfers. Do I have to say anymore? Anyway, so I started to have fun. I started to have fun because I always was boy crazy, you know. And here I was with these beautiful surfer boys with their hair when they get out of the ocean, you know, they're fabulous looking. And so anyway, I started to feel better about things, you know. And anyway, I especially started to feel better about it when we started drinking. Because my parents were like teetotalers. They didn't drink at all. And, you know, I asked my dad once, I said, did you ever drink a lot? And he said, I was too cheap to drink. And that was the way it was, you know. He saved every dime to try to be a millionaire, and that never worked out. Anyway, so I started drinking with the surfer boys, and they had these great parties at the beach, you know, big keg parties, and we all drank Red Mountain wine and these gallon jugs, and they had a little thing, and you could, like this with the bottle, the gallon bottle. And you go, "Arr, mateys," and you would drink the, and we also drank a lot of tequila, and and we had toga parties. I mean, it was the greatest, and I felt like I was in the best place on earth at the best time, and I was just happy as a clam. And then we moved to, well, I didn't move. I started going to surfing contests with these guys, and there was a. Always a bar by the surfing contest, and between heats, you know, the guys would go up and have shots of tequila and stuff like that. And so, I mean, it was fun, you know. And then there was this one particular surfer that I was madly in love with. And, you know, when I grew up, a lot of you guys won't relate to this, but, you know, I would watch movies like High Noon with Gary Cooper and, you know, movies with Gregory Peck, you know, and I saw all these movie stars and Viva Zapata, you know, I love Marlon Brando, and, you know, I wanted a boyfriend like them. By the way, I've never been married, I never had kids. So my plans for my movie star husband never worked out. Anyway, this guy, Ricky, he looked like Gregory Peck. And he was a surfer, and he had this beautiful nose. And, you know, you'd see him across the room. Oh, God, I remember the first time I saw him. It was like, oh. Anyway, so he asked me out, and I was, like, so excited that this cute surfer boy, and he was, like, a goofy footer. And, I mean, he was in Jacob's surfboard ad and all this stuff, you know. And so, he came to pick me up for our date, and he held out his hand. And in his hand were two two-and-alls. I don't know if any of you know what those were. Downers is what we called them. Anyway, so I figured one was for me and one was for him. And I'm telling you the truth. If it had been strychnine, I would have taken it. If Ricky offered it to me, it had to be a good thing. And so I took mine, and we went off to the party. And that was the first time I ever used drugs. And you know, by then it was like the 60s, and a lot of stuff was happening in the 60s. You know, I was so obsessed with my surfer boys and having fun and drinking. I mean, I didn't even know about Martin Luther King or anything that was happening in the, you know, the South. And, you know, Vietnam, I knew that a lot of guys were being drafted and had to go to war, but I, you know, there were so many things in the news or that was happening that was really important going on that I just totally didn't know anything about. And my father, well, my parents, you know, nobody, my mom, my stepdad, and my father, none of them had gone to college, and it was never, ever brought up that maybe I should go on to get a further education. And I was also a terrible student. They never diagnosed people back then that I know of having ADD. But I think I did. I mean, I was a dreamer. I liked to sit and look out the window and, you know, think about recess. There was only a couple of classes I liked at all. And so in high school, I kind of became a class clown. And I've talked to people in the last few years, and they say they had ADD. And I go up to them at the end when I thank them, and I said, "By the way, were you a class clown?" And all of them say they were. You know, it was like the way we cope with having ADD is we make jokes. Anyway, so where was I? I was with the surfers and drinking and not having anything going for me. So anyway, I had to go to work. When I was 15, I went to work, and I worked at the Fox Theaters, the Fox Lamar, which was in Manhattan Beach, and the Fox Hermosa. and then the Fox Redondo. And, you know, I always let my surfer boys in free. And the manager got mad at me because they were barefooted. But anyway, so I got away with murder, of course. And when I was at the Fox Redondo, that was when A Hard Day's Night came out. And I watched that movie like 12 times. No, 21 times. And it was a Beatle movie, you know, those of you that don't remember. But anyway, so my girlfriend and I, we went up to the Hollywood Bowl and we heard the first Beatle concert in the United States. And, you know, we became Beatle maniacs. And just then, you know, the whole English rock scene started and the Rolling Stones and everything. And so, you know, the whole culture was changing. A lot of high-powered sedatives were being taken, as Bill would say. By the way, it's in Bill's story. Read it and weep. Anyway, we were, you know, psychedelics, everything. And so what happened was I was like on, I had a minimum wage job finally at this pottery place in Manhattan Beach, and I was getting more and more in trouble. I got fired from the pottery place, and I went to collect unemployment, and they said, some guy, sympathetic guy, he said, you know what, we have a secretarial training program, and if you enroll in that, we'll let you continue collecting unemployment. I said, good deal. So I went, and I took this class. I was horrible at shorthand, though. I could never figure that out. But I managed to get through that class, even though I was disabled in the shorthand department. And anyway, I had this crazy Aunt Kay. My cousin is here, and it's her, well, her mother was a great aunt. My Aunt Kay was kind of crazy. And but Aunt Kay, one day she called my mom, and my mom does not have any tolerance for alcoholics. She doesn't like them. And Aunt Kay, she didn't like Aunt Kay, because Aunt Kay, you know, was the kind of person that would call them in the middle of the night and scream and yell. And my grandma lived with my mother then, and she would call my grandmother at night and cuss her out and yell and yell. And everybody loved Aunt or Grandma, but Grandma, you know, didn't like me. But anyway, so anyway, Aunt Kay one day called my mother. I don't know how come. And Aunt Kay worked at the studios, and she said, I'd like to help Mary get a job at Paramount Pictures. And so my mom, you know, well, sure, why not? And so I went up to Paramount, and, you know, they really wanted a college graduate. That's what they did. They could get the pick of the litter, you know. But somehow I got that job. It took a couple of months, but I got this job. I started out in the research library at Paramount, and that was when we used books, you know. And so, you know, art directors and hair stylists and, you know, directors and writers and all these people would call the library and have get books, you know, about, like, if they were writing a movie about Bugsy Siegel, they'd say, we need all the books on Bugsy Siegel. And, you know, you couldn't research anything through the internet. There was no internet. So I was the clerk, and I would deliver a lot of stuff all over the lot. And but I was still drinking, you know, and I was going to Whiskey a Go-Go by then every night. And it was post-Johnny Rivers, for those of you who wonder. Anyway, so, you know, I had this job at Paramount, and I lived across the street, well, across the alley, actually, from the house band at this bar in Hermosa Beach, and they were, well, it was Redondo, I mean, and they were the, they were a cover band for the Rolling Stones. Anyway, so everybody got high back then and drank. Mostly, I was like a beach drunk, so, you know, a lot of people were, they were too cool to get drunk. That was during that time, you know. They were all posing, you know. But, you know, I was the beach drunk. And by the way, I'd started putting on weight because I drank a lot of beer. But I would go to the Whiskey every night, and I had this roommate. And I always wondered how I had a roommate like her. She was really cute and a great dancer and all that. I thought, why don't she pick me as a roommate? And I think it's because I had a job, you know. A lot of people didn't have jobs back then, especially women, you know. And So I got to go to the whiskey every night. She'd get me in, and I had a Vespa motor scooter, and I'd ride to the whiskey. I'd ride to and from Paramount, too. I knew how to stock my Vespa up, too. I had, you know, in the front thing, I had a screen, little screeny thing, and I'd put 2 half-gallons of wine in there. And then on the floorboard thing, I'd put 4 six-packs of beer. I would stack them on top of each other, you know, and they fit on my floorboard just fine. And I would ride up to where I lived on my Vespa, and, you know, a couple times I'd fall off. Anyway, but I mysteriously never got hurt. I mean, it's like magic. And there was a time, I won't talk about drugs a lot. I mean, I won't be specific, hardly, but sometimes I have to be. Anyway, I would take Quaaludes on my Vespa and be, and you know, you would stop at a signal and all of a sudden you'd just roll over. Anyway, so I was at the point where nobody liked me at the whiskey anymore either. And nobody would invite me to their house because, you know, in the canyons, you know, you'd go to these parties and, you know, people would get really wasted and I'd go up on the roof and start yelling and screaming and, you know, everybody could hear you. The canyons go all the way, you know, sound really travels. And so people didn't want me at their house anymore, you know. And So I was getting really unpopular and starting to isolate a lot. And I had also shot dope at the beach with these cute surfers, you know. They knew what was good. So anyway, but so that wasn't a big part of my story. And I swear to God, my main drug of choice, if you want to call it that, was alcohol. I mean, that I could always get, and I was really afraid of getting arrested for some reason for drugs. You know, I didn't want to go to jail. I thought I could never survive in jail. Everybody made it really clear to me that I was going to have to take care of myself forever. There was nobody ever said, I don't remember my mother or my father or anybody ever saying, Mary, you're going to make a beautiful bride, and you're going to have beautiful children, and we're so happy for you. It was not that, you know, it was like no encouragement as far as being a beautiful bride ever. So I just knew that it was just me, you know, I had to take care of myself. And so I was afraid if I got arrested and put in jail, I was, you know, I didn't have a chance. So I really didn't want to get too deep into that world. And so, so anyway, what happened was, I was working at Paramount. Oh, and I started working in casting. You know, I started moving around in the studio, different jobs, because they closed down that research department when Desilu and Paramount merged. And so Paramount ended up with the studio. And so I ended up getting into casting. And I was working in casting. It was TV casting. And I got this crush on my boss. See, that was the thing. I got these long-lasting crushes. I mean, they lasted for years. And always with men that did not want to have anything to do with me. Nothing. I mean, they didn't even want to have sex with me. I mean, it was pretty bad. So, but I would be so loyal to them. I mean, I loved them, and I knew one day they would say, you're the one I've been waiting for all this time, and it's finally hit me. It's you. So anyway, I was madly in love with this casting director I worked for. His name was Ramsey. He's unfortunately passed away. And but back then, you know, I would get drunk at work all the time. We'd go to this restaurant by Paramount, and we would order these mixed drinks, and we'd come back just drunk. And I tried not to drink until after 5. But sometimes that didn't always work out. And I would go location scouting on the lot, looking for places to have my next party. Anyway, but I was, anyway, you know, when you walk by a stage, and, you know, there's all these crew guys in the stage, and they would sometimes they'd hoot at me out the door. And, you know, back then I was wearing, like, hot pants and, you know, I always thought I was, you know. Anyway, that's the way we dress, some of us. And these guys would hoot at me, and I would get terrified, mortified. I think, did I sleep with those guys last night? I mean, I didn't know. I didn't remember, but I thought, why are they hooting at me? Anyway, so I don't think I did. Thinking back, I probably would have remembered that. But anyway, Ramsey was sick and tired of my drinking, and I had also been taking some high-powered sedatives. And so I would start answering his phone, and I would slur. I'd say, Mr. King's office. And he heard me, and he knew that I was drunk on the job, and, you know, it was not professional. And so finally he fired me, and I was like brokenhearted, you know. Here he was, my hero, was throwing me out the door. And so, but I had union seniority. So, union, yes. Anyway, so I still kept, you know, I still got jobs at Paramount, but, you know, I'd go to the whiskey, I'd get really drunk, and I'd start thinking about Ramsey, and I'd call him up late at night, 2 a.m, Ramsey, how are you? And he got sick and tired. It was like Aunt Kay, you know, it was like, no, she can't call me. And so he, one night, he said, Mary, he'd call me an alcoholic before, but I would cry. I'd say, no, I'm not an alcoholic. Anyway, so one night I called him and he said, Mary, don't ever call me again. You're a drunk. And I swear that broke my heart. And then he said, but if you call me tomorrow, I'll call AA for you. And, you know, some people get to AA because their minister or their mother or their father or some important person in their life that cares about them sends them to AA. I got sober because I had a big, huge crush. And so anyway, I called these two drinking buddies of mine at Paramount. And I said, well, I told Ramsey I'd call him tomorrow and he would call AA for me, which, you know, that's not the way it works. But so these two girls said, well, don't wait for Ramsey. Our friend Jenny Gates has 12 years of sobriety, and she'll take you to meetings. And Jenny is also passed now. But she did. She took me to my first meeting, and my first meeting was on Ventura Boulevard in Studio City, and it was in the basement of a bank. And, you know, back then, everybody smoked. And so it was real smoky. But the speaker was this motorcycle cop guy. And that guy, the room laughed the whole time he talked. It was like amazing. He was funny, you know, and so everybody's laughing, and you know, I don't know if that was the night I said, well, I went home that night and I threw out all my alcohol. And then the next day they said, come to a meeting tomorrow. So anyway, the next day I woke up and I was starting to feel sick. You know, I hadn't been sober for years. And all of a sudden I didn't have any alcohol. Well, it was leaving my system and nothing else, you know. So I started to feel real sick and, you know, boo-hoo. So I called my mother. I was sure, you know, my mother, I couldn't manipulate her. She didn't care about me anyway. So I called her. I said, Mother, I went to my first AA meeting yesterday, and those people want me to come back again tonight. And I'm sick, and I got to ride my scooter. It's cold outside. It's the full moon. And, you know, I gave her all my list of excuses. And I thought for sure she'd say, Mary, you don't have to go back again tonight. What are they talking about? Two nights in a row? That's the way I saw it. Anyway, so but what she did is she started bawling her eyes out. She started crying like I couldn't believe it. And it still, you know, chokes me up now, because then I knew that she had been worrying about me for years. You know, I would, you know, get put in jail, and sometimes I'd call her to bail me out, and I'd get in fender benders with my Volkswagen Bug when I had that. And I'd call her and I'd say, Ma, would you take me to the junkyard? Well, not the junkyard. I'd say, would you take me to pick up my car? It's just a fender bender. We'd get there, it was totaled, you know. And so anyway, she had, you know, was very worried that I was, you know, going to die somehow or other. And when I said I was going to AA, I mean, it was like a blessing to her. And so she cried, and I said, well, okay, I got to go back tonight. So I went to my second meeting. I got lost on the way. I took my scooter, and it was at the Radford Clubhouse in the Valley. And I don't remember that meeting that well, except for I got there, I was lost, and I started asking people. I said, do you guys know Jenny? And they said, and somebody said, yeah, and he knew her number. And I called her, and I said, Jenny, I'm lost. I don't know where I am. I'm at a clubhouse. And so she came and got me, and so that was my second day of sobriety. And I think the third day she said, you should find meetings near where you live. And I lived in Hollywood. And so I started to, the first meeting in Hollywood I could go to was, well, it was the next day. It was Wednesday. And anyway, this meeting, it had spotlights like this on the speaker. But the rest of the place was kind of dark. Whoops. And in the back of the room, there were coffee pots like that. Only it was dark. And in front of the coffee pots were the bad boys. They had one sponsor. His name was Bill McHale. He died, too. And he was back there with his, and these guys, they were not movie stars, they weren't surfers, they weren't my type at all. But I found one that looked like a, he was my dream boat somehow. Anyway, so I got obsessed with a new boy that didn't like me. And anyway, so, you know, if there's anything that'll keep you coming back, you know, it's these fake love affairs. So, so I started going to every meeting, and we had a little circuit that we went to. We had a, every night of the week there was a meeting we went to, and I would just go to all these meetings. And the first time, you know, I'd never, my family was not a religious. And anyway, so one night I went to this little meeting. It was at the Women's Club in Hollywood. And I, there was a big parking lot, and I was walking back to the meeting, and I noticed that Tony's Volkswagen van wasn't in there in the parking lot. And so for the first time, I prayed to my higher power that I could sit through that meeting if Tony didn't show up. Because I was, by then, I didn't, you know, I had been, you know, to court about my drunk driving convictions. Anyway, I'll explain my voice problem in a minute. But so I made it through that meeting, and I kept going to meetings, and I got 30 days, and then I got 60 days, and I got 90 days. By the way, when I got 30 days, we gave chips down there, and I called my mom, and I said, oh, you have to come up and see me take my 30-day chip. I was so proud of that chip. And my mom came up, and you know, you could only speak for a minute, and back then, you could actually say something. In Hollywood now, or down in Southern California, where I live, they don't let you say anything. You get up there and say your name, and that's it, you know, and identify yourself, and then you're done. But back then, you could say, you know, I'm grateful, or whatever, you know, how much it meant to you to have 30 days, but you very quick. Anyway, but my mom came, and I was really proud. I was so proud. And so I started getting more time, you know, and when I got a year of sobriety, I think it was a year, I got elected secretary of a little meeting, the Polly Hall Young People's Group, and it was a nice group. A lot of people came from Cry Help, this one recovery house, and it was a great meeting, and I knew this guy, Peter Inn, and he was sober a while, and I said, I got to get great speakers for that meeting, and he gave me all the people that were big cheeses back then, and if they're still alive, I know them still, and I see them at meetings, but some of them have passed because it was 38 years ago, or 37, but it was a great experience to have my first big commitment. I had another one before then, I was at that meeting with the coffee pots in back. I ended up giving cakes there, which was not, the secretary was this guy, Eli, and he wanted a pretty girl, and I wasn't pretty enough. But the girl, the pretty girl, she had to move away, and she asked me to be the cake person. So, so poor Eli. Anyway, but when I had 10 months, he asked me to speak for 20 minutes at that meeting, and they thought I was funny. And so I started to make friends in AA, and I started, people seemed happy to see me, you know. And so when I got to be secretary of Holly Hall, I, you know, continued to make more friends, and it was a great experience for me. And so I, by then, was I was still working at Paramount. I was secretary, so time was passing, years were going by. Oh, when I first got sober, this to me is important. The groups I went to, they were serious about not taking anything that affected you from the neck up, if it was a pill or cough syrup or anything. And so they would say, you know, don't let your doctor prescribe anything to you unless it doesn't affect you from the neck up. And they really drummed it into us. You know, your sobriety is no good if you do that. I mean, if you take something like that. So I went to my doctors. I was, you know, like I said, a union person, and we had great health plans. So I went there, and I said, you know, you can't give me anything. I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic, and you can't give me any drugs or alcohol or prescribe for me anything that'll affect me from the neck up. I cannot take it. And so little did I know, but because I said that, they started checking my liver. And so after I was sober just a little while, they called me up and they said, we have noticed when we looked at your liver that you have non-A, non-B hepatitis. And I said, I've never been yellow in my life. You're crazy. Don't bother me anymore. Anyway, so time passed. You know, my work was getting better because I was sober. I was starting to be sober. When I first got sober, I walked around the lot and I told everybody, I'm sober in AA now. Ah. And, you know, because they had all these big rap parties where there was all this alcohol, and I was the kind of drunk. These fantastic parties, you know, and a lot of shows I worked on and everything. People would be there, they would sit in these tables and they'd mingle, and wasn't the show great, and wasn't this and that, and I would be at the bar like a, just, you know, I wanted to get as much alcohol as I could. I didn't care about being social or nothing. I just wanted to drink, and I was pathetic. I mean, I really was. The glassy-eyed person at the bar, oh, I think I'll have a drink. So anyway. So when I was sober, you know, I did. I started telling people right away I was in AA. I had no, you know, I wasn't worried about breaking my anonymity. And so anyway, so time started to pass. I decided I was too smart to be a secretary, which is stupid because I could never get a job as a secretary anymore. Not just because I'm old, but because I can't do it. But anyway, I decided I wanted to get become a film editor because I flipped over the call sheet. And when you do that, you see what jobs everybody has. And I saw film editors, and I knew that they got Academy Awards. And, you know, I was a newcomer, and I wanted an Academy Award. I wasn't going to settle for some crappy job where you didn't get an Academy Award. So I chose editing, and you know, I started, I got obsessed with that. You know, I'm really good with obsessions. I never let up. And I started torching the head of post-production, who I had no idea was the biggest jerk in the world. And but I wasn't afraid because I was obsessed, and I didn't pay any attention to whether he liked me or not. And so he said, well, you've never been to school. You don't know anything about editing, and who do you think you are, and blah, blah, blah. So I found a school that taught editing, and I went to it, and I read a book about film editing, and every week I was working on Laverne and Shirley then, and I would write him a memo, what I learned in school this week and what I read in my book. So, and I, you know, was working on a lot. So anyway, and he was He was very tough, you know. He wasn't about to get me into the union, and that union. And so I got this other job. I decided I wouldn't stay with Laverne and Shirley anymore because I knew if I had a job on the lot that was permanent, they would never give me this job in editorial. And see, there was also a thing going on, affirmative action, and women could get better jobs because we were minorities. Anyway, so I started, there was a guy that was head of personnel, and he was in AA. And so I'd go up to him, and his name was Art, and I'd say, Art, I've been on the list to get into editorial for a year now. What's happening? He'd say, Mary, in God's time. And so I finally said, screw that. So I knew this girl that worked in post-production. She had a good job. And I said, you know, I've been trying to get into post-production editorial for a long time. And she got me a job with that guy, the mean man. And, you know, that was when he told me I had to read a book or, you know, learn something about editorial. So anyway, after I met him, I started torturing him. And so I quit the Laverne and Shirley job, and I started working for this other producer guy. And his office was on the second floor. And if you went into the ladies' bathroom, you could look out the window, and down below was Paul's office. And so I'd see him go outside, and he would talk to, you know, important people. But I didn't even care. You know, I would run down the stairs, and I'd go up to him, Paul, when are you going to get me in the union? And I just started torturing him. And guess what? One day, he surrendered. So I got into post-production, and that career lasted me till I retired. But you know, it worked out pretty good. We were on celluloid for a long time. That's just regular film. And then everything went digital, and it became tough unless you were really connected to somebody. And my nepotism didn't go that far. My aunt, by then, was no longer working for the studio. But I finally got into post-production, and then I started freelancing, and then it got tougher because the technology changed really rapidly. And but anyway, I stayed sober all through that, and, you know, I had AA relationships that were, you know, I didn't pick well, and they weren't too picky. So, which means I paid the bills. You know what I'm saying? And I kind of got sick of that. I said, you know, you artists are interesting, but you're too expensive. So I stayed single because I just couldn't work that out. But I started going, you know, early in my sobriety, I started hanging around at Venice Beach. And AA in Venice, all over Southern California, it's probably great up here too, but it was great down there. And we had, you know, we had AA Beach, and we had dances. And, you know, early in my sobriety, it was the greatest thing to be in AA. I mean, we did so many really neat things, and, you know, it was practically all for fun and for free. And I just started to fall in love with AA. I think I've been on a honeymoon for 38 years. You know, I've had hard times in 38 years, I'll tell you. But I've never felt really bad. I've never hated AA. I never want to go back to a meeting as long as I live. Nothing like that. I always loved AA and the fellowship. And I've worked the steps over and over because of the defects of character. I'm a master of gluttony, greed, and sloth. So, you know, those have brought me to different 12-step programs. And, you know, you work the steps in there, too, and it's all the same steps, and you do the same thing over and over, only on a different level, you know. So so I'm pretty well-versed in the 12 steps, and I think it's just amazing. It's a gift that Bill Wilson and all the people that wrote the big book, when they did, had that inspiration, that divine, whatever it was, to write the big book. I mean, you read it and you want to cry because every sentence applies, you know, and it's like, how did they know all that? And they didn't even have, a year sobriety or something like that. They were new. And anyway, so time was passing, and how long have I been talking anyway? good. Well, that's... Anyway. So, so what happened was in 1997, well, earlier than that, about 1995, I was going to the doctor, and they said, well, they told me before that, they said, we've identified what you have. It's hepatitis C. And I, you know, I said, okay. And but I still wasn't feeling bad or anything. But as time started to pass, you know, I started to develop all these weird symptoms, and I'd go to each doctor for each symptom. But nobody thought, oh, this is hepatitis C, or that was what's causing all this stuff. It was all these weird different things happened to me physically. And so finally my doctor said, you know, there's a hepatologist over at Cedars and we think you should go to see him. So I went to see him and he decided I should go on interferon. And back then when they first started giving you interferon, I mean, it was the Black Death. I mean, it was, you got so depressed. It was like the worst horror movie you could ever see. And so I was not working, I think, when I went on interferon. And, I mean, it was pitiful. I felt horrible. And sometime during that time, I was working again. And I started, you know, you bloat up. And so I would wear these leggings to work. And I'd wrap my ankles with ACE bandages. And I swear, when I take off these leggings at night, it smelled like potatoes, you know? Because, you know, you start, your legs are totally swollen, and, you know, water seeps out of them, and it was potato-smelling water. And so, and I was turning all kinds of purple and blue and everything, and I got really weak, and they said, don't drive, but my job was way out in the valley, and I thought, well, I can't afford to not work, so I would drive anyway. And but I would get to work, and I would sit in my car. I was so weak, I had to wait till I got enough strength just to walk into the building, you know. And we worked in this big warehouse where they would shoot the show, but a lot of times they'd go on location, and there was these little dressing rooms in there. And so when they were out on location, I would go in these little dressing rooms and just go to sleep. I was so weak. And my boss... I worked for people that really actually liked me, and they felt bad for me, so they would let me go sleep in the dressing room. And then, you know, I had jobs, I had work I had to do, so I would sleep all night in, or well, not all night, I would sleep a lot in those little dressing rooms, but then I would come back into the cutting room, and I would sleep on the floor, and then... You know, like 3 a.m, maybe I'd wake up, okay, I got enough energy to do my job. So I would do it when nobody was there, late at night, and I would get it done, and then I would drive home and wake up and go back and do it all over again. And that went on, and what happens when you have late-stage liver disease is your brain gets all messed up, and you start, and you know, you get to the point where you kind of hallucinate crazy thoughts, and that happened to me one day, and I started to cry, and I called my doctor at Cedars, and I said, you know, I know there's something not right, because I'm not thinking right. And he said, get over here right now and get into the emergency room. And so I had my friend's boyfriend take me to Cedars, and all the way I begged him. I said, please stop and get me a hamburger. I knew they weren't going to feed me there, so he wouldn't stop, though. But I remember that clearly. The hamburger was on the top of my mind. So anyway, and you know, before that, I had to go through all these tests at Cedars where they check your, to make sure that you won't die from, if you get a liver transplant, you won't die right away because you've got some other thing going wrong. And so I went through all these tests and everything, and I swear to God, I would walk around Cedars, I'd follow directions where I had to go, what time I had to be there, all that stuff. And I never once thought I was going to die. I thought, once I was walking across the bridge, and I thought, you know, I might die from this. And it was like within seconds, it was gone. I just never thought I was going to die. And so I was in an emergency room for 3 days, and they were keeping me alive. And then one day, my doctor came in, and he said, we have a liver for you. Do you want it? I said, yeah. So they gave me a new liver. It was a young boy. He was 16. I have a liver transplant. And So I started to, you know, and then they gave me this, you know, they give you a lot of drugs when you're getting a liver transplant because there's a lot going on. You know, you get a new organ, and it's a major organ, and so they start medicating you a lot. And I was in there, and all of a sudden, I mean, it was like a lightweight Gabby Giffords thing. I couldn't talk. It turned out I couldn't talk. I couldn't walk. I couldn't raise my arms up. I was like a crab, sort of crab in cement, laying on the bed. And they found out, which has always made me laugh, I must say, that I had a toxic reaction to the drugs. And so anyway, so they finally figured out why I was getting so sick. And I was actually dying. And they figured it out, and so they switched my medication, and I started to get better. And then I had to go through physical therapy, and, you know, because I couldn't walk. I couldn't do anything. And, you know, I would stand on a curb, and, you know, you would think getting off a curb is easy. You know, it's only like how many inches. And I would be so petrified because I would be so stiff. And I'd think, if I walk off this curb, if I step off this curb, I'm going to fall flat on my face. Because, you know, I couldn't bend my knees. I was just so terrified and stiff. And so it took a while for me to get better because physically I was a mess. And but because of the toxic shock, not because of the liver transplant. And when I got out of Cedars, they said, don't go to any big with a lot of people. Don't go anywhere with a lot of people because they have germs and your immune system is compromised. And if anybody has a cold or anything, you'll get sick and you'll die. And I said, ha, because my favorite meetings were big. And I wanted to get back to my meetings. So I started going to my meetings right away. You know, I had a walk. First, I had a wheelchair, and then I had a walker. And I went to meetings, and I didn't get sick. My immune system was perked up. You know, you come to meetings, and it's not supposed to happen, but I really think it's magical in these rooms. And, you know, you just have some kind of guard against bad things happening, and so, I mean, of that nature. And so I started to get better, and, you know, it took me a while. I would sit in participation meetings, and, you know, I'm a talker. I like to talk. I like to complain. I like to talk about good things, bad things, everything. And but I couldn't talk because I would know I wanted to say something, but I couldn't, you know, verbalize it. And but eventually I got able to speak again. And, you know, I can speak pretty good now. I can blab. Anyway, so what happened was, I thought, well, I'll never work again. Nobody's going to hire me. I had a liver transplant, and I almost died. I can hardly walk. I can hardly talk. And one day, I was going to go speak at a step study in the valley, and I was reading the 12 and 12, brushing up, you know. And the phone rang, and it was this guy. I hadn't seen him for 10 years, and he was a film editor. And he said, Mary, I got this pilot. The schedule is horrible. You know, they want it delivered in no time. You know, it's horrible schedule. Horrible. Horrible, horrible, horrible. And I think when he was complaining about this new show he got, he hired me. And so anyway, he on and on and on about what the terrible schedule and everything. And then it seems like it went on like 20 minutes. And finally he stopped. And he said, so what have you been doing? I said, well, I had a liver transplant and I can hardly walk or talk. Is that okay? Yeah, come on out, you know. So he hired me. And that was the beginning of me going back to work. And I stayed working for a while. And and then, you know, you get old. You notice I have gray hair. I'm 66 now. And, you know, thank you very much. I survived. And so I worked for a while after that. But, you know, the technology and, you know, I don't want to insult you men, but when I was a young girl, a young lassie, and I first started out, men did not want to touch a keyboard. Nasty. That was women's work, you know. Typing. Ew. I mean, I guess if you were in the military, you didn't mind typing, but otherwise, You didn't want to know anything about it. But then computers came out, and suddenly men wanted to learn how to type. And so, and then they wanted the girl jobs that we all needed. You know, they wanted to be assistants, and they wanted to blah, blah, blah. So anyway, they really embraced technology, and all of a sudden, everybody wanted men assistants, and they wanted men everything. And even the women editors that were real established wanted men assistant editors. And so it became not just tough because of the technology, but because a lot of men took a lot of the women's jobs, which I'm not blaming you guys, not you guys. But, I mean, it was tough. And I was actually on the board of directors of the Editors Guild for almost 20 years, and but there was nothing, you know. I couldn't get anything done because there was no real training. It was tough, you know. If we could train each other, then it would have been better, but they refused to let that happen in my guild. So so anyway, eventually I couldn't get jobs, and my last jobs were non-union and for editors that hadn't worked with assistants before, and they, you know, it was really getting not weird as you would think it was weird, but just tough. And so I was going to this meeting. It's called Life After 10, and I was crying. You know, I'm not the kind of person that when I go to meetings, I want to always have the answer. You know, it's like, and the solution is blah, blah, blah. I used to say, you know, I'm not working and I'm in pain. You know, I don't know what's going to happen and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, this lady kept coming up to me at this meeting, and she say, Mary, there's a mixer in the marina for people in show business, and you should go there. I know they could help you get a job. And I thought to myself, I'm a union worker. These people are actors that never got a job and writers that never read anything. And I said, they can't help me do anything. And so, but I, you know, I finally got to the place where I was so desperate, I went to this place in the marina, and the meeting was pretty much what I thought. But it was in this California some kind of thing, and when I walked through the lobby, I noticed on the wall, it said, 55 and older, affordable housing or something. I said, well, I'm 55 and over, and I can't afford to live at the beach anymore, that's for sure. So I checked that thing out, and the first place I went, it was not, you know, wasn't exactly what I thought it would be. But then on the counter, there was a thing, and it said, this apartment building, it's a historic Art Deco building. And they said, 55 and older, come here, and you can live here. So I went there, and because I knew that this woman, a superstar in AA, lived there. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for her, it's good enough for me. So I went there, and I applied, and I got an apartment there. And suddenly, you know, I had to move, but suddenly I was living affordably for me. And you know, I crashed and burned financially again, you know, but I got through it, and I was living within my means finally. And I went to a meeting in our building, and this guy said, well, you know, the LA Opera is hiring. And so they were ticket sales, you know, it was like that. It was telemarketing, actually, but it was people that had been to the opera. It wasn't people that they got out of the phone book or anything. Anyway, but I didn't know anything about opera. I never spoke Italian. I never spoke French. I never spoke German. I didn't know anything. But I got hired because I had on my resume show business, and I guess that was good enough. It was, you know, there's times when they've sold a ticket to everybody's going to buy one, but they still want some people to, new blood, you know. So they needed some new blood. I was the new blood. And so I went to the library. I got operas out of the library. You know, you can get CDs and DVDs, well, DVDs mostly, and VHS cassettes and all that. So I started, I spent one weekend listening to every opera that was in the new season. And, you know, a lot of, if you don't go to the opera, there's super titles where you can read in English what is being sung in German or whatever it is. And the music is awesome. And, you know, you don't realize until you go to an opera that a lot of the music you've heard a million times, because it's such beautiful music, they use it in all different ways. And so anyway, I became a ticket seller for the LA Opera, and you know, I had to say everybody's name phonetically because I didn't know how to say things in Italian or any language that everything is written in. And so I phonetically would say the and fake it like I knew what I was talking about. And people would listen, okay, yeah. And sometimes they'd ask me, well, who's singing that role? And I'd go, I don't know, you know. I knew the superficial stuff. But anyway, I started selling opera tickets, and I learned a really important lesson there, and which has nothing to do with AA. But I thought, you know, the economy was bad, and I thought nobody's going to want to buy opera tickets. I mean, nobody has any money right now. But people bought opera tickets, and I found out if you love something enough, you will find a way to buy opera tickets or whatever they are. You know, if it's baseball, whatever it is, you'll find a way to buy those tickets. And so it was a great lesson for me that, you know, we do things that we want really bad enough. Anyway, so I was selling tickets to the opera, and finally I got old enough to get, you know, all my pensions and everything. I only have two, but that's all. And so I retired totally. And, you know, you think, what are you going to do when you retire? And I was very active in AA. I never lightened up on my AA. But, you know, so I slept late. It was nice. And but I was secretary of this little meeting next door to where I lived. And it was a meeting where a lot of guys came from recovery houses. And they didn't have money for the basket. And the rent was, it was a senior center, and the rent was high. And so when I moved to Hollywood first, when I first moved back, I had joined the Hollywood Hills West Neighborhood Council because, you know, I wanted to fit in the neighborhood. And I still went to AA meetings, but I felt I should get into the neighborhood. So, but I had quit that neighborhood council because people complained. I mean, they did not like any progress in Hollywood at all, and they were mad. So I just got sick of that real quick. And then I so anyway, when I was secretary at that meeting, I realized that if we could get the rent reduced, it would be better. So I thought, well, I'm going to go to the neighborhood council again and become a member and get a hold of the city councilman and say, you know, you got to reduce that rent because I heard he loved that senior center. So I went to the neighborhood council, I got involved, and, you know, I couldn't get the rent reduced, and I actually never even got a hold of the city councilman. But I got committed to that, and I've actually done some nice things involved with that neighborhood council. And then after a while, I go to this meeting on Friday nights, and it's in Brentwood, California. And, you know, I'm poor. I've always been poor. I've been a poor girl my whole life. And, but this is kind of there's some snooty people there. Anyway, they asked me to be secretary. I thought, what? I'm not one of you people. I mean, I'm sober, but, you know, and I had a lot of time, but I didn't feel that I was the kind of person that the steering committee wanted, but they did, and they said, well, you know a lot of people, so you would be good for this group, and I finally said, oh, okay, I'll do it, and so I became secretary of this meeting on Friday night in Brentwood, and it's been a great experience. It's been over 6 months now, and finally, I was a central service representative. I don't know what you call them up here, but it's, you know, there's general service representatives and there's central service representatives. And LA has a Los Angeles central office, and, you know, they always brag that we have 24/7 phone lines, that we get calls from all over the United States and all over the world, in fact. And so we have volunteers doing the phones and stuff, and I actually do a phone shift now. And but anyway, so I was going to the CSC meetings, and that's the committee. And there was personality problems. Let me put it that way. Personality problems, big time. And, you know, I had been on the board of a labor union, and so I was, like, amazed at the way these meetings were being run because they weren't following Robert's rules or anything. And a lot of people started to complain about the way it was being done. And, you know, we really wanted some transparency with the finances at central office. And so we started complaining. And finally, these two guys had run it for 18 years. You know, they rotate the jobs back and forth. Everybody was going crazy. And one night they said they were stepping down. It was like, oh my God, because we thought we were stuck with them till they died, you know? Anyway, so they decided to step down, and I started worrying, well, what if nobody says they're going to take this job? Because one was a treasurer, the other was a trustee. And so when the night came when they finally decided to step down, and they got up in the middle of the meeting in a huff, and they cursed their way out the door. And anyway, so we did an emergency election for trustee and treasurer, and the trustee guy, he was already wanted to do it. And the treasurer, that position was open. There was supposed to be one guy that was going to run for it, but he didn't raise his hand when they asked for people who could present their qualifications. So I immediately raised mine because I was afraid that if we didn't replace those guys that were leaving, then we would be in big trouble. And because I was afraid they'd come back and say, well, we're only kidding. Ha ha. So anyway, I ran and I won the election. And so I'm the treasurer of Los Angeles Central Office now. And I mean, that is a miracle. And my whole thing, thank you. My whole thing, when they said, what's your qualifications? I said, I want to make it transparent. That's all I cared about, was letting everybody know what was going on with the finances at LA Central Office. And, you know, I'm not a CPA, I'm not an accountant, I'm not a bookkeeper. You know, anyway, so when I took office, the trustee, he said, how come you ran if you didn't have these skills? I thought, what? I didn't know. I thought I just wanted to make a trust. But, you know, as miracles happen in AA, somebody when I was a newcomer just happened to be at a meeting one night, and the office manager talked to him, and he responded, and I recognized his voice, and my head whipped around. It was this guy, and I said, and anyway, we became friends again, and he happens to be a genius, and he started helping me with reading spreadsheets and all that stuff, so I'm actually learning some stuff about being a treasurer, and it's getting better down there, and a lot of people are really grateful that the other people have left, and it's going better. And so my retirement, I do everything for fun and for free. I don't get paid for anything, but, you know, my life is so good now, and I feel so... You know, I can sleep late, my hours are better, but I work hard now, you know, between the three commitments I have, and I'm just so happy to be sober. Every year I feel more blessed that I am sober, and all the things I thought were bad, you know, I thought, poor me, living in Hermosa Beach, I was a little girl, nobody likes me. I was so blessed to be born in Torrance and live in Hermosa. I mean, how many people in small villages around the world would love to live in Hermosa Beach, you know? And, you know, the things I feel that were wrong in my life, I was so lucky to be in that place at that time. And I'm just totally grateful. And the longer I'm sober, the more grateful I am. Thank you very much.